Hey, it's Joe. I've got GLP-1 drugs on my mind. Ozempic, Wegovy, semaglutide. They're the hottest topic on the internet right now. And to be honest with you, I've been tempted. Look, I don't have 100 pounds to lose, but who wouldn't want to drop a stubborn 10 and knock the body fat down a few points? On top of that, these drugs are being hyped as longevity drugs. Good for your heart, good for your kidneys, good for your liver, good for everything, right? Hey, I just want a microdose. So I asked Dr. Vivian Lowe, who recently wrote a book on GLP-1s, to come on the show and tell you and me what's the real story here, what's true, what's hype, and what GLP-1 drugs might cost us that nobody's talking about. What? The internet might be wrong? Yeah. Let's talk to Dr. Lowe. Dr. Vivian Lowe, welcome back to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Hey, it's been 2 years. I've been looking forward to chatting with you again and kind of catching up. I understand that there's been a lot going on for you. Why don't you tell us?
2 years. Okay, now that you actually quantified it, it just felt like a long time, but 2 years. Yeah, a lot has been going on, this life as usual. But I've also been working on my medical e-zine. It's called Wellthy, Wellth-E. And basically, it's an electronic magazine that focuses on health, on wellness, but in depth. So it's not going to be superficial dives. So far, I have some issues out that I think your listeners would be interested in. And I'm going to direct them specifically to issue number 3, which deals entirely with muscle and all the new stuff that I've dug out on muscle health. Awesome. And related to that, I've also been working on my book, which focuses on GLP-1s. And you know, that's the hot topic today.
Oh, yeah.
You know, everywhere you go, you're going to hear about the Ozempics and the Wegovys and so forth. But I think not so well known are some of the concerns, medical concerns around the use of these medications. So I wrote the book to address not just the medication, but our medical system and how it's always fragmented, right? So we'll deal with something like weight, and we come up with what seems to be a miracle drug, and we'll put it on board. But we're not asking the questions of what other systems might it be disturbing, and what's that going to look like down the road, 5 years, 10 years, you know?
Sure.
So that's definitely something the medical system is not good at doing, because we're all into just looking at one metric and everything's riding on that metric. And we assume that, oh, everything's going to be better because we're just looking at the number on the scale, for example.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. You know, frankly, I look at my number on the scale and think, wow, I'd like that number to be a little lower. And if there was a pill, I could just take a pill and it would, you know, make all that so much easier. It's very tempting. So I don't blame people for being interested in it. But if I'm going to like injure my health, well, I don't like that.
Yes, I think that's a big concern. And, you know, where the GLP-1s have been mostly injectables, recently the oral version has come out, right? So it's this oral Wegovy. They're, I think, promoting that quite a bit. And people who might have been reluctant to get shots might be thinking, oh, like you said, I got a couple of pounds. This might make it easier. Why don't I get myself started on it? But I think there's a huge amount to consider, especially, I think, for your population of readers, you know, who are fairly athletic, who are already taking care of themselves, are concerned about their health. They're doing everything to maximize, you know, their performance and so forth.
Yeah.
I think that these drugs, you'd have to think at least 50 times very deeply before you consider being on them in that population of users.
All right. Well, let's get into this, because I've been tempted. I read that as a sign that a lot of people like me are tempted.
Yes.
Because it just sounds so good. Now, there are some negative side effects that you hear about. You're going to lose muscle mass and things like that. You know, but it's, hey, I exercise. So, you know, I'd fight that muscle loss off. But maybe there's other things that you're going to end up telling us about. But on the good side, mm-hmm. What's even more compelling is it's now talked about, this GLP-1 as like a longevity drug. It's good for your cardiovascular system. It's good for your kidneys. It's good for your liver. It's, you know, it's good for everything. And so, gosh, yeah, lose a few pounds, but on top of that, live forever.
And probably good for world peace too, right? And God knows we need it right now, right? You know, the way that it's being hyped, it's good for everything. So I think the main thing to separate out there is are the benefits due to weight loss per se, mm-hmm. or from the drug specifically? So if you were to just lose weight, you know, why are your jaws shut? Do bariatric surgery, whatever method you use, you lose weight, and you're going to have health benefits if you're starting off in a category where you have inflammation and obesity, correct? That's the population they're primarily talking about, people who have health risks because they also have obesity and the related medical conditions, okay? Yeah. And they're saying, oh, you know, it's a miracle, it's making their sleep apnea better and so forth. Well, a lot of the times, the sleep apnea is secondary to the weight. So if you lose the weight, then it's better. So you theoretically can say that, but it is probably not a direct effect of the drug. And one way I have people think about this to try and sort it out is to ask, where is the GLP-1 receptor? Because the drug is going to directly affect the GLP-1 receptors in your body. Now, if there's no receptor that you can think of, it's very likely that it's a general weight loss effect that you're seeing, okay? But if you can identify a receptor in that tissue, in that organ, then perhaps we are seeing some direct effect of GLP-1s, okay? So, but way before we even go into that, I think for your audience, what I'd really like people to know is that metabolism, anytime you impact someone's metabolism in any way, you are impacting the immune system. Okay, so a metabolic intervention is always an immune intervention and vice versa. If you have an immune intervention, it's also a metabolic intervention. And that's something we have to keep in mind, because basically your metabolism is the energy management system in your body. How you regulate and manage energy in your body, right? So you can just think of this department that decides, okay, well, we're going to give a certain energy budget to the liver, to the heart, to the lungs, to your muscles, okay? And we're looking at the supply that we're getting. So we're trying to match supply and demand all the time. Now, if we are finding that the supply is low, maybe I have to decrease the activity in certain departments, right? Cut the budget, you know, make some layoffs, right, to manage that deficit. So there's always that going on in your body. And if you think of your immune system, to activate your immune system, you need energy. So anytime you activate your immune system, it's a demand on your metabolism to supply it with energy for the troops, which are your immune cells, for the liver, because the liver has to make all kinds of proteins that, you know, send out signals to the rest of the body that, you know, you are under attack, let's say. So you make these what we call acute phase reactant proteins. You have to make signaling molecules like cytokines. Right, you can imagine there's tons of stuff that your body has to generate to mount an immune response, and that's going to cost energy.
Okay.
So now here I'm going to say something that people have never really discussed, and I think it shocks quite a lot of people to think of it in this perspective. So, you know, a lot of people think of insulin resistance as a bad thing. It's something we have to shut down in the body. We want to prevent insulin resistance because ultimately, if that's uncontrolled, it can lead to diabetes and inflammation and so forth, okay. Right? What I want to present is actually insulin resistance is a natural physiologic adaptation. It happens in your body naturally and in a healthy manner to adapt to various conditions in your body and environments. Okay, so whenever you have an infection, you will actually have some degree of insulin resistance. Whenever you have an infection or inflammation, I'm going to say that again, you will have some degree of insulin resistance. So to be clear, what that means is now the GLUT4 receptors in your muscle and in your fat are not really effectively and efficiently taking the glucose into the cell, into the muscle cell or into the fat cell, correct?
Okay.
I'm saying then we have some level of insulin resistance. So this means that there's more glucose that spills out into the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. And again, traditionally, we have thought of it as a bad thing, but I think this is actually how our bodies were designed. Because when it spills into the bloodstream, this gives the immune cells access to it.
Access to the energy.
Yes. The liver gets access to it. Your brain gets access to it. And these are the tissues that are needed to mount an immune response. So when you get sick, your body automatically has to divert that energy. And it says, yeah, you know what, muscle, you're not getting that much. And fat, we're not, yeah, forget that, guys. We got to get this to the immune cells. So let's shut down the GLUT4s a little bit. Let's tone it down, guys. Got to leave some for the troops, right? And that glucose spills out into the bloodstream, to the liver, to the brain, and then you can have that energy. You have those resources to mount an immune response. And that is why I say any immune effect is a metabolic one. Any metabolic intervention is also an immune one, because certain metabolic pathways will switch on immune cells as well. Okay, and just to be clear, we see that also in pregnancy. That is again where your body has to adapt, and you want to spill out some glucose so that it stays in the bloodstream and it gets to the developing baby. Correct? So that is adaptive, and most, and you know, I think we don't think of it that way, but you will be in a naturally insulin-resistant state when you are in pregnancy, because that's how your body was designed. So that's how inflammation and insulin resistance are linked. We never hear about that. We're like, oh, inflammation, oh, you know, insulin resistance. And they seem to be two separate things, and they're vague in our minds, and somehow they're there, and somehow they're bad. But if we think about it from the body's perspective, it makes perfect sense, and it's really good design.
Okay, from a layman's perspective, let me try to simplify this a little bit and make sure I'm understanding it.
Yep.
That inflammation is essentially the immune system, and inflammation is a good thing when I need my immune system to do something important, something that's a little more,
correct,
you know, energetically demanding.
Yes.
And the inflammation is the sign that the immune system is doing that thing. And if I've got an infection or I've got an injury or something, then I'm going to have some inflammation. But it's not going to stay around forever. It's going to go away when the problem goes away.
Correct.
Whereas if I have insulin resistance all the time, inflammation all the time, I'm an unhealthy person. Am I getting that?
When you have chronic, so it, as we said, yes, you got it correct, because in the acute situation to manage a cold, you know, yeah, someone has pneumonia, for example, or a skin infection, yes. You know, in the short term, we need some insulin resistance to fuel the immune cells and the immune system, correct. But if someone is in an unhealthy state, practicing unhealthy health habits, so for example, they're eating junk, they're not sleeping, that kind of thing, right? That is a stress on the body that also revs up the immune system, but this time in a chronic way. So it's not come and go, right? Once and done. It's now, it's lingering activation of your immune system. Now at this point, yet then you are also constantly trying to feed an activated immune system. And so you are likely to have this insulin resistance now go on and perpetuate. Eventually, it could become diabetes.
Okay, so tell us how these GLP-1 drugs, which are, as I understand it, they started off as diabetes drugs. They were a way to get blood sugar down. They discovered that the people that were taking these drugs lost weight. It was kind of amazing, yep, how much. So then they started shifting their focus toward, well, how do we make them better at losing weight? And so that's, I guess they still are a diabetes drug, and it's been around for longer than people know. But as a weight loss drug, it's fairly a new thing. And somehow what it does, as I understand it, is not elevate your metabolism and make you burn more energy, but rather it gets into your brain somehow and says, you don't like eating anymore. You don't crave the things you used to crave. They don't give you pleasure. And so you're just not as hungry as you used to be. And so people eat less and they lose weight. Am I right about that? Tell us how they work, but then tell us how the GLP-1s relate to this inflammation and insulin resistance that somehow is a problem.
Okay. So yes, you got most, you've got it right in the general sense, but I'm going to fill in some points. Right. That's because a lot of times on social media and so forth, you hear a lot of people talk about it as a gut hormone, and it certainly is a gut hormone. But there are other cells in your body that make GLP-1. Famously, it's made in your brain as well, but it is also made in your pancreas. And then, you know, some lung tissue, we are not sure what it's doing there. Okay, so it's not just confined to the gut. And so every time you hear about, oh, it's a gut hormone, that's how we know it by. And it's not, when you're using it in the sense of the medication, it is not functioning at the gut level in that direct way. Okay, because you will hear people say, oh, you eat certain things, you eat more protein, you eat more fat, you make your own natural GLP-1. True. However, the half-life is 2.5 minutes. And less than, is about 10% on a good day that will eventually get to the bloodstream. Okay, so we're not really talking about the local gut effect. And to talk about GLP-1, the main thing to talk about is that it isn't produced like insulin. Okay, the way insulin is produced is we make this precursor molecule, we chop off a little bit of it, and now becomes an active hormone, and that's insulin. That's really not how GLP-1 works. And I think this is the amazing thing about GLP-1, because the original molecule is called proglucagon. It's a big-ass molecule, okay? Mm-hmm. And what we've learned is that you can cut it up with different enzymes and you will get different products. So there again is the efficiency, right? So I give this example of flatworms. You know, planaria. And the amazing thing about planaria is if you take a flatworm and you cut it into two, each of the two pieces will grow to be a full flatworm, new worm. Okay?
Good trick.
Yeah, if you cut it into three pieces, three new worms will be formed by fission, by cutting it. And they've generated, I think, like 279 new worms from one original worm just by chopping it up that much. Okay? The point of that is each fragment is biologically viable. Okay, so when you take proglucagon, which is a big ass molecule, and you cut it up, snip, snip, snip in different proportions, you get different hormones. Okay, now there are in your gut, you will normally have enzymes called PCSK1 and PCSK3, and they will cut in from the L cells of the colon, they'll produce this proglucagon, and then the PCSK1 and 3 enzymes will chop up this big molecule into different fragments. We will be making GLP-1, GLP-2. We will make glycentin, and then we cut that down into oxyntomodulin. So do you see that when you make GLP-1, you don't just make GLP-1. You make a family of products.
When I take a GLP-1 drug, I'm not taking GLP-1. I'm taking something that turns into GLP-1 and other things too.
No. Great question. And that is the difference, because your body makes it as this big molecule. You chop it up and you get different products in a one-to-one ratio, right? You get...
Okay, so that's the natural way.
Yes. But when we replace it, we're just giving you GLP-1. F the ratio. You see what I'm saying?
Okay, so I'm missing all the other things.
Yeah, we're slamming this one thing on board. Okay, and let's forget about that's why I want people to understand the basic physiology first, because you can now tell what's, because they always sell it as, this is natural. Okay, well, not really. Okay, so.
And what is it, like 100 times the endogenous dose, and it lasts for 2 weeks instead of 2 minutes?
So what they've done is they've modified the peptide, right, chain that for GLP-1, and they so that it persists longer in your bloodstream. Because like I said, there's an enzyme called DPP-4, which will degrade it in two and a half minutes. But now when you modify it, then it can't be degraded, so it will last longer in your bloodstream. So, you know, it would be like the dose itself is thousands of times what your body would make. But the actual biologically available fraction is the unbound fraction. And that's 0.1 to 0.3% of the dose, which still makes it anywhere from 4 to 70 times higher than your endogenous body makes.
Okay, so not exactly natural.
No, no. It's actually overriding your own biological system. And the other thing just to go back to is that, you know, we haven't fully explored the other fragments, but they work. The reason your body makes it as a family of hormones, right, is that they work together, okay? And they adjust. So, for example, GLP-2 has had some effects on the brain itself too, and on the gut in terms of helping cells grow and keeping them healthy and so forth. So it's not that you just produce these other hormones and they're not important and the star one is GLP-1. The one that we are concerned about is GLP-1 now, because all we are thinking of is weight loss, right? So that's why. Now, in terms of the diabetic effect, these drugs are known as incretin drugs because the GLP-1 has the effect of increasing insulin production, which is how it helps you in the diabetes state. Okay, so your pancreas, it turns out, also makes proglucagon, and instead of the beta cells which make insulin, it's the alpha cells that make proglucagon. Normally, you would have the enzyme PCSK2 cut it up so that you get glucagon, okay? But under stress, under hyperglycemic conditions, like after a meal, or even in normal glycemic, some studies have shown that you will actually now start making the enzymes PCSK1 and 3 and cut proglucagon so that you have GLP-1. That GLP-1 and GLP-2 and oxyntomodulin. The GLP-1 piece can go to the beta cells and stimulate the beta cells to produce more insulin and protect the beta cells from dying as well. So it has some beta cell protective effect. Okay. So, okay, we're seeing now regional effects of the PCSK, of the proglucagon and how it's cut up. And that happens in the brain. So we actually make proglucagon in the brain, and we have the enzymes to cut it up so that we have GLP-1 exist in the brain itself. The GLP-1s that are made in the brain affect the areas of the brain where we have found GLP-1 receptor. Remember earlier I said, ask where the receptors are. The receptors are primarily in the areas that affect motivation, affect energy regulation and appetite control. Right, your feeding centers, your energy, your hypothalamic centers, your energy regulation centers, right? And they are in areas that affect, you know, emotional processing and anxiety and things like that. Okay, so some of the effects that you see from these medications could be that the GLP-1s are affecting different areas of the brain. So that's kind of the broad view of GLP-1s. Now, you're perfectly right in saying that it makes you not want to eat because it decreases your appetite. So let's go there and look at that more closely. It turns out, you made a statement, you said it doesn't actually affect your metabolism. And technically, that's not correct. And it turns out that we've known since 2022, but again, it seems to be very little known even among medical circles, that when you actually have GLP-1 present, it will stimulate the production of brown fat. Okay, now brown fat, you know, is fat that is metabolically active. It burns off energy in the form and you know, kind of transforms it to heat,
yeah.
right? And so it can be seen as wasting calories that way and helping people lose weight that way. And so that's always been sort of the holy grail of medical research for obesity. Oh, if we could just have more brown fat, that would help us, right? And it turns out that actually that's what we are seeing is that the fat cells, the GLP-1 affects the precursor fat cells and they produce more brown fat. And so we have increased thermogenesis, right, from brown fat burning.
Mm-hmm.
But the primary weight effect is not from your increased brown fat at all. It's mostly, like you said, from not eating, not wanting to eat, losing your appetite.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in my talks on GLP-1, and I also mention it in my book, my interest in GLP-1 did not come about from, you know, sort of the obesity literature. My interest has always been in metabolism and primarily in immunometabolism. So really, I didn't really care about GLP-1. Yeah. You know, blah, 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 blah. But it, when I started to see, you know, these reports that they noted that ICU patients had high interleukin-6, this is an inflammatory cytokine, right? And that makes sense. If you have sepsis, you're in the ICU, you're definitely, you know, not in a good shape and you have a lot of inflammation going on. So you produce a lot of interleukin-6. And it turns out that that interleukin-6 increases GLP-1 in those patients.
Oh.
Okay. Now that, and it's not just one study, it's been reproduced and we've seen numerous studies that have shown that. That is really what made me interested in GLP-1, okay? When I saw the immune link. And remember what I said earlier, any metabolic intervention is an immune one. Any immune event is also a metabolic one. So think about it. You have sepsis. You're in the ICU. You have a lot of massive inflammation going on. So you make a lot of interleukin-6 or IL-6. And you also make GLP-1, which is technically a metabolic hormone. So you see now the link between the two.
And it's pretty common that when people are sick, they're not hungry.
Oh, so we're getting there. Mm. Okay. So the IL-6 actually directly stimulates the cells in your intestines, even in your pancreas and so forth, to make the GLP-1. Mm. But it turns out that we can actually have the GLP-1 produce IL-6 in immune cells as well. So when GLP-1 binds, and there is GLP-1 receptors, you will find the GLP-1 receptors, let's say on monocytes, macrophages, and so forth, binds to these immune cells, and then those immune cells are going to produce interleukin-6. And what we do know, we've seen it in animal studies, is that when you put the animals on GLP-1, we see an increase in interleukin-6. Okay. And that interleukin-6 is an inflammatory cytokine that we see in sickness, and it brings about what we call sickness behaviors, which means, just like you said, when you're sick, you don't want to eat, you don't want to get out of bed, you just kind of don't want to talk, you have low energy, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, when they start the GLP-1s, what do they say? I don't feel so good. And they lose their motivation to find food. They lose their motivation also, because it does impact the motivational circuits in the brain for drugs, for alcohol, right? You've seen those reports where it seems to impact the addictions and all that. So we're seeing at least definitely there's some intersection of the immune arc and sickness behaviors and the metabolic arc. And it makes sense because when you are sick, again, I said, that's why I started with the brain making these decisions of, okay, what do I do? Where do I send the energy? Okay, we're going to have to shut you down here because I don't want you running around looking for food. We need the energy for the immune cells to fight this bacteria. So that's what we're doing.
So the GLP-1, am I getting this right? The GLP-1 is making the body think it's sick.
It has a direct effect on the feeding centers, but it also is working through that circuit of the sickness circuit, yes.
Well, I don't think I want to feel sick.
No. Now, here's where it gets very complicated. Okay, so we haven't really looked into the immune metabolic link in people who are put on GLP-1s, yeah? So just very broadly, what we do seem to know is that in the early stages, let's say the first 8 weeks of being on GLP-1, your interleukin-6 levels do rise, but beyond that, they seem to fall. When you are chronically on these medications, the interleukin-6 level falls. We have taken that as a good sign. We always seem to think that low interleukin-6, for example, is a good sign.
Low inflammation.
Yeah. Again, it's not as simple as that, of course, right? You know, let's just take a pause and realize that our bodies are amazing, right? And in such a complex system, I'm constantly in awe of the human body. And to think that simplistic little, simplistic circuits can fix everything. There's so many bypass mechanisms and pathways, because otherwise we would never have survived. You see what I'm saying? So that's why I think the danger is when we oversimplify it. So yes, in that instance, you know, there is a sickness effect. Long term, though, as you lose, let's say, excess visceral fat, for example, especially, lose the fat in your liver, then your overall inflammation rate goes down, and that does seem to drive down the systemic IL-6 levels. Okay, and at this point, everybody's cheering. Yay! But we're only midway through the movie, so this is not the end of the story, you know. The villain's about to reappear, right? And here I want to introduce IL-6 properly, because everybody thinks of it as an inflammatory cytokine. Okay, and so IL-6 is the bad player. So if we see a high IL-6 number, it's bad. And if it's low, it's good because you're healthier. Let's take a step back first. IL-6 has three voices, three that we know of. Right. Okay, and it's how it's signaled. Okay, so the signaling pathway, how your IL-6 binds to the IL-6 receptor, there are different scenarios for how they bind. Okay, one scenario is a homeostatic scenario, which is actually good for housekeeping, getting rid of debris in your tissue, right? And primarily, very important in muscle health. So every time you go and you exercise, right, you go to the gym, you do a hard, you know, resistance training session, you should be raising IL-6 in your body. And when you do that, right, that it's going to be IL-6 working in this homeostatic signaling pathway. And this long-term is going to stimulate muscle growth. If you shut down IL-6, right, you're not going to have the hypertrophy effects and the muscle growth effects. Okay? So in this scenario, we need IL-6. Okay, so that is one voice. Another voice for IL-6 is the one that we mostly focus on, which is the inflammatory voice. So the way it binds to the IL-6 receptor is in such a way that it's actually an inflammatory signal instead of a homeostatic signal. See what I'm saying? So in that case, yes, it can cause more damage. It can recruit more immune cells that might do more damage to your tissues and so forth. Okay, and then there's a third signaling pathway. We don't have to worry about that. That is basically immune cell talk. They talk to each other within that system also. Okay, so let's focus on the two pathways, the homeostatic pathway and then the inflammatory pathway. Now, the problem is that the homeostatic pathway is very important for health. So, for example, in the developing brain, we need IL-6. Particularly in puberty, when the brain is developing, we have to prune certain circuits in the brain, right? You can't let the neurons just grow wild, and that can lead to a lot of wiring problems. So healthy brain development depends on this pruning effect, which needs IL-6.
Oh.
Okay. So if you depress IL-6 in that setting, not a good thing. Okay, let's take someone with a stroke. Okay, so someone has a stroke, and if we see, then you have damage because there's not enough oxygen, let's say, to different parts of the brain, right? Mm-hmm. And then that's an emergency. So your cells are going to, your immune cells are going to say, oh my God, we need like to do something. We have to send a signal. We'll send this big immune signal, the inflammatory signal of IL-6, correct? And the higher we see that IL-6 in that initial phase, the more damage is correlated with it.
Okay.
Okay. However, after the initial strike of the stroke, in the days following, we need, there's a little phase, lag phase, and then we need to see another rise in IL-6. Without that rise, right, you won't have proper angiogenesis and repair of the brain circuits. So if you suppress that second blip in IL-6, then you're going to get into trouble because you won't allow the brain to repair properly. This is not only true in strokes, it's also true in traumatic brain injuries, concussions, TBIs. So there's a rise, initial rise, that is more an inflammatory signal, but the later, you know, few days out, whatever, you need to have that second blip.
All right.
Okay. And if you don't, then we're in trouble. And they've shown that if you use, let's say, a lot of omega-6s on those TBI patients, right, they don't recover well. It impairs their recovery because you're not allowing that inflammatory, second inflammatory rise that signals repair. That's why I'm saying it's way more complex. And maybe the best way to back off is to think of your immune system. Classically, we think of it as inflammation, no inflammation, on-off switch.
Yeah.
We need to think of it as a spectrum. And anti-inflammation is still part of your immune system. Okay? So sometimes it's good to have more anti-inflammation or be more anti-inflammatory, but sometimes it is worse. So an example of when that is worse is, let's say you are too anti-inflammatory in general. So your tumor surveillance goes down. Your T cells, immune cells, are supposed to identify tumor cells and kill them. But if you are too anti-inflammatory, then that's not going to happen efficiently. And, you know, one of the things that they're working on in oncology, in cancer research, is to, you know, wake up the T cells and make them more aggressive so they attack the tumors more. So to think of your inflammation system, your immune system as inflammation good, inflammation bad, anti-inflammation good, is really just too simplistic. That's not how it works. Mm. Both inflammation and anti-inflammation are part of the immune system, and we put one state on in certain contexts and we put another state on in certain contexts, and it's not just be anti-inflammatory all the time. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, and I imagine that the leap here is that you're going to say, if I'm taking a GLP-1, I don't get the up and the down the way I used to. I'm going to get a change that makes it more of one way than it should.
Yes. And because long-term, chronically on GLP-1, we actually suppress the IL-6, generally, right? So we definitely change the immune tone. And this may be as one way that makes it more difficult for people to maintain muscle mass when they are on these medications. Okay, so given what you just said at the beginning, and you told me that, oh, you know, there's this stubborn, let's say 8 to 10 pounds, you know, why not just, I've been struggling with it for the last 2 years, why not just take this, get, be done with it, right?
Yeah.
The danger is that someone like you, and I consider you pretty fit, you know, you're not someone I want to even risk your muscle mass for, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, and you just think about this, we have to think about what is the long-term outcome, which is also my concern with the industry, right? So I want you to think of the scenario. You have someone with obesity and diabetes. And you say, let's put them on GLP-1s. And you know what? You should be on it forever. Okay, so say this person is 55. And when the person hits 65, okay, all of a sudden, been doing the same thing, nothing different, eating the same way, right? All of a sudden, we see the A1C go up, okay? And we realize at that point that, I started with a person who had obesity and diabetes, and now I have a person with sarcopenia and diabetes. Yay. What did we do in those 10 years? Did we really help? I don't know. I don't think so, right? So again, it's not to say I'm not, and that's the thing, I'm very against just the one size fits all. I'm not saying that nobody should be on those medications. I'm saying we should be very clear why we're on those medications. We should be very clear for that patient. And we have to think about what is our criteria for success in that patient and what is the exit strategy for that patient. Just like any business, you start something, you better know how you're going to get out of it, right?
Yeah,
makes sense.
Yeah. Well, and we have heard that people have got to stay on the drugs for the rest of their lives. And I've heard people worry we don't have studies that go that long, so we're not really sure what's going to happen. But for this audience, I think for me, I've only been thinking of, you know, what they call a microdose. You know, I'm just going to take a little bit because I don't really need
a microdose.
Yeah, go ahead.
A microdose is still a supraphysiologic dose. Yeah. You think it's a microdose, right? But any pharmacological dose, micro or not, is supraphysiologic.
Yeah.
You know, the dosing in your own body at peak is in picomoles. Tiny, tiny, tiny. And so even a microdose is many times that.
I see.
You understand? So, and the weight loss effects that you would get from a microdose of something like, let's say, the semaglutide, the GLP-1 there, it's not going to be that different from doing phentermine, which is straight up, you know, appetite suppressant also, you know. So, and it's way cheaper, right? So again, at that point, I'm like, okay, what are the risks and benefits? You know, and again, at where you are, for example, and it's that 8 to 10 pounds, I would say I don't think it's worth it.
Yeah.
Personally, you know, when you have a healthy person, not giving personal advice, but I'm just saying when I see someone who's very healthy, my tendency is to go, I don't think it's worth it.
Yeah, if you're not losing a lot of weight, you know, the argument that I've heard that is a compelling argument for a person who needs to lose 100 pounds is, look, I need to lose this weight. I haven't been able to do it forever. I'm going to lose this weight and then I'm going to get my diet, my health. I'm going to start doing things right, but I need to get over this hump, but I'm not going to stay on the drug forever because I'm going to get control of myself. Well, that's a compelling argument if that actually works, but for a small amount of weight, like I would want to lose, I really just should tighten the screws a little bit and lose a couple of pounds.
So the studies have shown that people 1 year out from stopping the medication, without changing the good dietary and lifestyle habits that they've developed, that people, 75% of people regain most of the weight.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so that's the stark reality, is that you're going to be regaining once you stop. So the person who says, oh, because then I'll get on a good track, the studies actually show that the people who stopped, they remained with their good habits. And they still gained weight. Oh. They did not change their nutrition. They didn't like suddenly go out there and go to, you know, fast foods and start eating junk. That they actually were preserving their healthy habits.
But they still put weight on. Yeah. Well, it's such
And there's
thing.
Something.
I mean, I'm sure you're a regular person like me, and we all have this craziness of where we've got this voice that's like, eat it. You know, you walk by the plate of brownies and it's like, I'm not eating that. I swear. I'm never. And then you're eating it and you're like, how did that happen? How did I change my mind?
Yeah. Well, I think that's something that I always like to bring up, is that, you know, your body was adapted for many, many things. It's an adaptive and responsive organism. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the way we're living now is something that, you know, the changes that we've had in our environment and our lifestyle is way too quick and such a big change from the way we were designed, you know, from what we were designed for. And so the body really doesn't have hasn't had a lot of time to adapt. And what you're trying to do is live in a body that was adapted to, you know, much older days, and then trying to make it work in this environment. And so we won't have that discussion about what kinds of foods are available. We won't have that discussion about whether our lifestyle is sustainable or not, in terms of the stress, in terms of the mental health problems that it generates, right? We won't have that discussion. But then we'll you know, point the finger at people and say, well, you know, you should know better. You should just eat better. And it's like, you know, we have to think about what's going on. I mean, I find that most of my patients are very responsible, very successful people, and they're not stupid. Mm-hmm. But they're trying to balance taking care of everyone, mm-hmm. right? And managing the stress, managing, you know, all the different, you know, responsibilities that they have. And their only solution a lot of times is to use food to self-soothe, to calm them down, to give them some measure of a moment of reprieve before they go back to the grind.
Yeah, I'm familiar with this. And I guess that I was recently telling my children that I used to use alcohol when I was young to loosen me up, mm-hmm. and I'd be more mm-hmm. interesting when I went to the bars, you know. And I appreciated that, but in the end, that was the wrong answer, because then I didn't have to learn how to do it. What I should have done was learned how to be comfortable in my own skin instead of using a drug.
But who teaches that, Joe? Who teaches that, right? Yeah. Who even cares about it? Like, you go, does anyone, I mean, there's no time. You go to see a doctor, they got poor things. They, I mean, we have 10, 20 minutes max on a good day.
Yeah.
You know? So doctors are suffering. Doctors are unhealthy. Doctors have poor mental health, you know? So you expect someone who's already themselves struggling to keep everybody else healthy, and that's just not going to work.
Yeah, I hear you. It is still, you know, I mean, so I am not an overweight person. I've never been. And so I'm the last person who should talk about it. But I've still got the little voices that tell me to eat things when I'm not hungry and go back and get more. And, you know, I have the voices too. And it would be so awesome to turn that off. Or tune it down to not crave that thing anymore that I can't stop myself from eating. But if the cost is that I have to like injure myself, then maybe it's just not worth it.
So that is the food noise that you hear people talk about. And they, you know, what happens, a lot of them share that once they start on the GLP-1, that remarkably that food noise goes away and they're not compelled to go look for food or to, like, you know, order something to eat or grab the brownie that's sitting there, right? And again, that's something that I think we need to pay attention to. You know, there's no shortcut without certain consequence. Everything has a price attached to it, right? And we have to make that decision of what we're willing to pay. And I think especially as we get older, I am more and more reluctant to sacrifice muscle mass in those patients. That's number one. Yeah. Number two is we are already, you know, and we're, okay, on a good day, we're fine and everything. But you have the flu, and that's a catabolic state. You go have your hip replaced, that is a catabolic state, right? And surgeons are saying to me, I don't want my patient on GLP-1s if they're coming in for surgery. The anesthesia people are worried about, oh, you know, there's gastroparesis, the stomach doesn't move as much, and so they could aspirate and things like that. Okay, that's anesthesia. But the surgeons are saying the wound will not heal. I do not want these people, because you can't be catabolic and expect your body to heal. Your body has to say, okay, we're going to heal. We need building blocks. We need protein. Where am I going to get that from? Who am I going to give the energy to? I've got to prioritize something. And you already cut down the energy supply, and the body's like, well, that's great. Now how am I going to heal? Right? So in circumstances like surgery, illness, maybe prolonged travel where someone's sedentary and they're not, you know, like I just went to India to give a talk and it took like 36 hours to 30 to 40 hours, you know, the return trip was longer.
Terrible.
Just stuck, you know, you're just sitting there and I kept thinking, you know, probably losing muscle mass, you know, as I'm sitting here, I'm looking at my legs and going, yep, you know, I wonder what's going on down there. So those are situations where, you know, or someone, you know, they have the hip replacement. Besides the healing, they're not weight bearing. They're not getting up completely. They're not moving as much, right? And here we go. Then the muscle loss is going to be even higher.
Yeah. All right. Well, so as we start to wrap this thing up here, I wonder if, I mean, there's going to be some people and maybe nobody listening, but they'll know people who are still tempted. They think they've got to do it for the weight loss, for all the health benefits of that. What should they do to have the best chance of not injuring themselves, losing their muscle mass, et cetera, on a GLP-1?
Okay. The number one thing is please do not, seriously, do not, you know, listen, I don't have any, like, aside from the fact that I wrote a book on the topic, I don't have anything in the game. But please do not go to some kind of platform where some dialer doctor just presses a button, you know, and then prescribes you with something, okay? And now gyms are jumping into it, and, you know, there are all these different platforms that say, hey, we can get you your GLP-1, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, very little scrutiny. Please do not do that. And you're not getting any medical care follow-up.
No. No. And the minute something goes wrong, who are you going to contact? You're going to contact your poor primary care who was out not knowing that you were on it or just didn't know what was going on, doesn't even probably know your dose or whatever. Okay? So, and it's not fair. You know, your primary care is now expected to clean up and mop up the mess. That's really not fair, you know? So at least, you know, have a discussion with someone who's really going to be involved in your care, whether it's an obesity medicine doctor or your primary care or whoever, or your endocrinologist, whoever else, okay? So the number one is please do not go to these platforms. I personally do not recommend it. Okay. And number two is, you know, I tell people who are going to start these medications, look, why don't you, none of the studies were without lifestyle intervention. So the max results that they got in the studies were always with weekly visits to the dietitian and a coach. And this was intensive weekly for 72 weeks. And then they got those results. Okay. So when people say, hey, I'm not losing. Yeah, you're not doing what they did in the study. So what I tell people is actually, why don't you start doing some of the behaviors beforehand, which is to plan out your meals and structure your meals. And then when you get into the cadence of doing that, and I recommend regular meals structures, scheduled meals. So then by the time you start the medication, then you're already, like, you know, used to having your dose of protein every X number of hours and so forth. So we at the very least, we have that structure in place so that you're getting in your protein, okay, you know. So that's, and getting in your fluids, because dehydration is also a big risk here.
So you
want to start that and do that concurrently. And then at the same time, like, I think your listeners are very good at, you know, kind of taking care of themselves by going to the gym. So the gym and the sleep need to be spot on. So it's not, some people think that it's just to bypass all of that, right? But to, if you look at the real world results of people versus the studies, right, people don't do as well and they quit, you know, like the medications within a couple of months, and they're disappointed. And I can't tell you how many people have told me, oh, I thought I would lose more than that. And I was like, yeah, did you know that every single study, the patients had intensive lifestyle intervention and coaching and dietary, like, blah, 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 visits and so forth and exercise. Did you know that? They're like, yeah. Oh, no. And so it's sold as, yeah, take the thing, you're great, right?
Yes.
That's not really how it works.
That is terrible that people are led to believe just the magic pill, and they don't have to do it. It takes all the responsibility away.
That's right. And I think I've seen some of the advertising that says, you know, you can eat whatever you want when you are, and it's just like, okay, please, you know, I mean, I'm sure it makes someone a lot of money when they say that, but
oh, I'm sure that's
it's
right.
It's not true.
All right. Yeah. Vivian. Well, thank you very much. This has been helpful. You've warned me off. I'm not doing that. Tell our audience how they can find you, your, I think you already did mention your e-magazine. Your name, tell us the name of your book and how we can find it.
Okay, so the e-zine is wellthy.com, wellth-e.com.
So wealth as in money?
Wealth as in money and wellness,
wellth. Oh, so
hyphen e.
Wealth.
Yeah. Okay. And you'll see, you know, in the about page, I talk about how those words are linked.
Okay, great.
And then my book is called The Architecture of Enough, Hunger, GLP-1, and the Immune Metabolic System. And you can find that at Barnes & Noble, at Amazon. There's the ebook version and also the you know, the paperback version. So there I go into depth and I talk about the immune metabolic system as well.
Well, and anybody who's followed the podcast for a while and listened to your past episodes, they know that you go into the weeds and you find practical reasons for things based on the science. So you don't disappoint. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
All right, Dr. Lowe. Hey, you have a great night.
You too.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Thank you so much for joining my conversation with Dr. Vivian Lowe. You can find more information about Dr. Lowe in the show notes.